Dayton had everything it needed to really become one of the centers in the country for industrial output and wealth creation and the entrepreneurial spirit.
Welcome, and thank you for listening to the NextGen Podcast, a conversational series with members from Energen Wealth Partners at UBS. With an understanding of the family dynamics that can accompany multi-generational wealth, we are experienced in working with you and your family to develop a strategic plan to guide your decisions. Our approach helps provide education across generations to help define and support your long-term vision for your wealth.
Hello, and welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Sean Nicholson, a certified financial planner and advisor with Energen Wealth Partners here at UBS Financial Services. Our office is located in Dayton, Ohio, and you can reach us at energen@ubs.com. We have a local guest with us today, a Dayton native. His great-great-grandfather fought in the Civil War and later fell to his death in downtown Dayton after falling through a bridge scaffolding. His grandmother played host to 7 or 8 relatives who slept in her dining room for months to escape Dayton's historic 1913 flood. These were some of the family stories our guest, Brady Kress, grew up hearing. So it's no wonder Dayton history has such a firm grip on his heart. Today, Brady is president and CEO of both Caroline Historical Park and Dayton History, organizations that preserve and display some of the city's most precious historical treasures. Brady, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I can't believe you found that bridge story. That's pretty...
I got to hand it to Cora. She's a good investigator.
Yes, yes. Quite the researcher.
Yes, yes. So maybe we can just start off with a little history lesson for some of our listeners who are maybe not always familiar with Dayton about just a broad outline of what Dayton is all about a little bit.
Sure. No, it's one of these cities that many years ago, they called it one of the gems of all the interior cities in Ohio.
I've heard,
so
yes.
Yeah, so we today are still known as the Gem City. But it's one of those towns that was carved out of the Northwest Territory and folks came up through Cincinnati to found it here on the frontier. And they found the water power and the fertile soils they needed to grow a town. So all the rivers come together right there in Dayton. And they weren't real happy in 1913 when we flooded. But boy, it really did take off. And there was a seemed to be with that water power and those investments early on and this faith in free enterprise that Dayton had everything it needed to really become one of the centers in the country for industrial output and wealth creation and the entrepreneurial spirit.
Yes, it seems like Dayton flourished and then grew through several different phases from the agricultural industry all the way through the printing industry and the automotive industry, and just kept going into the aviation industry.
It did. It did. And we have a lot of local companies that they really navigated the changes in market conditions quite well. You have companies like Stoddard Dayton, as you mentioned,
yes,
that started off
right
building farm equipment and then got into bicycles and then eventually into automobiles.
And you have some wonderful examples of those at the park.
We do. We do. Yeah, we have those at the museum. Huffy is one of those stories as well.
Yes.
He started off with sewing machines, Davis Sewing Machines, and then bicycles, motorcycles, lawnmowers, sporting equipment.
They just kept going. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of wonderful stories like that that somehow without you, they would be lost. And it's so important to preserve that great history. I mean, I look over at the cash register exhibit you have there in the main building, and those are works of art.
They really are. Yeah. And so that's a whole story in itself, right? The formation of a National Cash Register Company.
I
think it's when folks think of Dayton, Ohio, it really is one of those calling cards internationally that folks can look back to. You could travel the world and find an NCR register somewhere.
Yes.
And stamped on the back is Dayton, Ohio. So it was this great calling card internationally, and it meant everything to Dayton.
Yes.
For 125 years, those first 50 years, especially in attracting talent and investment and spurring leaders in the business world that would go on to start other incredible entities.
Yeah.
And we talk about Edward Deeds and Charles Kettering as being two that are locally known.
Yes.
But, you know, we talk about Thomas Watson, who went on to help form IBM.
Yes.
He was John Patterson's top sales agent.
Amazing. A lot of people have no idea about that.
Yeah, yeah. And he took with him the Dayton NCR sales training manuals and the company songs else, including their favorite slogan, I think, which is people associate it with IBM.
Yes.
It started at NCR.
Oh, what a great story.
And Watson took it with him.
Had no idea.
Patterson didn't do anything about it, but that's okay. The rest is history.
Yeah. I often think about those early salespeople who had to carry those cash registers from town to town and demonstrate them how heavy those things were and what a good job that was to set up and assemble.
And in those early years, you're correct. Those early years, they were under threat. They'd walk into a merchant with one of these big registers. They're lugging this thing around.
Yeah.
And the people behind the counter were calling them thief catchers.
Oh, geez.
And they didn't want an NCR salesman anywhere near them. And so they ended up coming up with smaller units that were sales demo units that they could hide under their coat.
That's
just a three-key unit to get in to finally get to the owner.
Okay.
And so it was
I wondered how they lugged those big things around.
Yeah, no, it was great. But wonderful photos in our archive of NCR cash register deliveries and all over the world.
Okay.
Being pulled by ox carts in Asia.
Yes.
And dog sleds up in Alaska. I saw one in picture just the other day in Belgium, and this guy was in a rowboat.
No kidding.
He had a cash register in front of the boat, and he was rowing this.
What these salespeople had to do to get those things out and about.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at all the parts that went into one of those cash registers is just amazing. And you have a wonderful demonstration or look at all the different things they had to put in there. It was amazing.
It really is. And one of the visitors in the early 20th century was Henry Ford. And you could really say that his River Rouge plant was based a lot on the NCR plant here in Dayton, taking ideas from John Patterson. It really was one of these places that raw materials would come in one end and finished machines would come out the other end.
Yes.
So it was really, really fascinating. And that, as you mentioned, is one of the many stories that we like to tell at Carillon Park.
Yes.
And telling those unique tales that had national and international implications from right here in Dayton.
Yes.
So with 65 acres at the park and over 30 buildings, including large kind of anchor buildings, one dedicated to transportation history and one to manufacturing and entrepreneurship. And then the third, which is really fascinating, is our Wright Brother National Museum.
That's the one that seems to catch a lot of interest from people outside the city.
You are correct. Yes. If we see a lot of international traffic and national traffic, out-of-state traffic, it's to come see the 1905 Wright Flyer III, what the Wrights considered and experts considered the world's first practical airplane. The 1905 was one that really contains in its engineering all of the main factors that we use in modern flight today with the pitch, yaw, and roll.
That was amazing that they were able to figure that part of it out, isn't it?
Yes. And it almost happened by accident. You know, Wilbur playing with a empty inner tube box, talking with a customer and messing with this box in his hands and looks down at it and says, boy, you know, if we could warp the wings like I'm warping this box, we could attack the air at an angle and have control. And they proved that in 1902 with their glider. Then in 1903, they come back and affix their engine and hand-carved propellers.
Yes.
And it's a proof of concept. But it really isn't until they have some success in 04, but it's not really till 05 they build a completely new craft, taking everything they had learned in those years leading up to it and building something that was sustained flight. They were testing this at Huffman Prairie here in town, and they could circle that field, they could perform figure eights, they could land, refuel, and take off again. And it was considered practical flight. And at that point, they said, look, we have something here. We've done this. So they didn't fly for 2.5 years after that while they secured their patent and tried to reach out to different governments, the U.S. and then England and Germany and Italy and France, and say, we have something here. We can't show it to you, but we have conquered the air. And so there was a lot of doubt.
French people were really the first to kind of adopt their methods and really appreciate what they'd done.
You're correct. And they started flying themselves. So by the time the Wrights, you know, after that 05 flight, by the time they really got to a point where they were ready to demonstrate, there were other people flying. Mm-hmm. But when Wilbur shows up in France and takes the field with that flyer, and this would have been in 1909 when they were in Europe, the French turn to each other and say, "We are but amateurs." They had never seen something.
Well, that's what
so
got
smooth.
The whole world's attention when they started winning those awards in France, right? Even the U.S. government said, maybe we should be looking at this for our military
right.
at that point.
Right. Well, and that's when this Wilbur went to Europe and Orville was here to demonstrate for the U.S. military. And that's when Orville was in a crash.
Yes.
And was injured. And it was the first, he had a passenger with him, Lieutenant Suffrage. And that was the first modern aviation fatality was in that crash. And so, and Orville broke his hip and walked, had pain for the rest of his life.
Amazing he survived it.
It is. It really is. That they both survived.
What a story. I mean, I love going down and walking through the exhibit there and seeing the bicycle shop. And it's just an exciting place to be.
Well, thanks. Yeah. In that complex, the Wright Brother National Museum is a four-building complex. And we are very fortunate that our founder, Edward Deeds, who was the third CEO of NCR and co-founder of Delco and built the dams and levees that protect Dayton. And
right. A lot of people aren't aware of all that he did.
Edward Deeds is a name that everybody should know.
Yes.
And they don't.
Underappreciated man.
Yes. But had his hands in all kinds of things. But he was best friends with Orville Wright. You know, of course, by that time, Wilbur had passed away in 1912. And so as you get into the 30s and 40s and 50s, Orville did a lot with Edward Deeds. And so Edward Deeds and Carillon Park ended up with a lot of artifacts and personal effects from Orville and from his family. So Carillon Park is the, we have the largest collection of three-dimensional objects anywhere in the world.
Nice.
And so that was one of the factors, including us owning Hawthorne Hill, which is just a couple miles from Carillon Park,
right.
Orville Wright's success mansion. It was one of the reasons that we attained that national designation as the National Museum. Our friends down in North Carolina have the monument. We have the National Museum.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We are the true home of the Wright brothers, as
yes.
much as they don't like it.
Right. That's right.
Well, I've taken the tour at Hawthorne Hill, and it's wonderful. That's a very unique place, and I'm glad to see it being maintained and run under your auspices.
Well, thank you. It's one of those, you know, prized possessions in the Dayton History Collection, and we're very thankful to NCR that maintained it and kept it safe for
yes.
so many decades.
Yes.
Folks might not realize that after Orville passed away, the family, he didn't have any kids of his own, and so it was nieces and nephews that already had their own houses.
Yes.
And so they put it on the market. They tried to hand it over to the National Park Service, and Orville passes away in 1948. And so there was such a backlog after World War II
yes.
for the National Park Service that they were not interested at that time. And so they put a for sale sign out front at Orville Wright's mansion.
That would have been terrible.
And, right. Yeah. So luckily, Edward Deeds and Stanley Allen from NCR, they caught
the
wind
foresight.
Of it and said, you know, let's preserve and protect
yes.
this landmark. So they buy it and they use it as a corporate guest house for decades. In fact, the NCR used it for longer than Orville did.
Oh my.
And so, you know, unfortunately, after 125 years, when NCR decided to leave Dayton, they were trying to figure out what to do with their assets around town.
Yes.
And so in cooperation with the Dayton Foundation and the Wright Family Foundation, the house ended up with us in private hands as a private nonprofit.
Wonderful.
So it's great. We're preserving it. We provide those tours, as you mentioned. But it also, one of the fortunate things of us having it is that folks can use it for functions.
Yeah.
We can welcome people to town. We can have receptions there and business meetings and so forth, which might not be possible if the Park Service owned it.
Correct. Yeah, we've had a couple of nice functions up there, and you do a wonderful job. It's a great tour, and everybody who goes through the tour really appreciates it. So that's wonderful. And now, what's going on with Carillon for the future here? I know there's a lot of things. I was down there and rode the new train. And in fact, one of our clients is now an engineer there. So we keep an eye on it, but it's really fun for the family to do.
Well, we hope so. And thank you. I'm glad you enjoy it. And as you say, the conductors and our volunteers and our employees and our donors, is what makes it all work. We couldn't do it without them.
Right,
we're a donor-driven organization. We're not receiving any tax dollars for operations, so that's what it takes. But with regard to the future and what we've been working on, we like to say that Carillon Park will never be complete as long as there's entrepreneurship and innovation in this town. So we continue to add things, and we continue to add things that we don't want to be generic.
Okay.
And so we really search for, we have some of that, obviously, but we really search for those unique stories that no one else in the country can claim.
Well, the football locker room.
Indeed. Indeed.
The triangles.
That's one of the things that we are working on as a new sports heritage facility related to Dayton. And that's a great example of a collection of stories that no one else can claim.
Right.
So a big piece of that is, as you say, the first game of the NFL played in Dayton, Ohio in 1920.
Yeah.
Huffy Olympic time trial bikes built here.
Interesting.
McGregor golf equipment
from
Dayton, Ohio.
Didn't realize that.
The Soapbox Derby from Dayton, Ohio.
So it's really not an Akron product.
It's not.
Okay.
It's not. And Canton can't claim the first football game either.
Okay.
So it's Dayton, Ohio. Those are just a few. The American Amateur Trap Shooting Association here in Dayton for decades.
Yes.
And so those are the kind of things that, you know, we don't want to be, like I said, a generic kind of Me Too museum. We've got our one-room schoolhouse, and so does every other, you know, every county in the country has one. You know, you go to museums all over and they have something like that. So we love our one-room schoolhouse, but we're trying to, as we grow, we're trying to capture those stories. And folks don't realize that Dayton at one point, the Dayton area, was the seventh largest industrial center in the country.
Wow.
That we held more patents per capita than any other city in the country.
Amazing.
In the, that would be from that time period, about 1890 till about 1915.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Yes. And so it's a place of incredible innovation and invention. And we still live under this blanket of prosperity that those folks planted.
You're right. We're still benefiting
this
from
town.
All that.
Yeah. A lot of legacy companies and families that are still very, very generous, that thanks to a lot of those early investments and ideas and inventions.
Well, I know that you've renovated the printing press area, and that looks wonderful. Some of those printers back there are still working just like they did when they were first built.
That's right. They are. It's one of the largest early 20th century working print shops in a museum anywhere in the country.
It's amazing to watch those things run.
It is. And so that's a lead into us being able to talk about in the museum Dayton as a printing town and as a paper town. And things that folks might not think about, but you have, you know, the largest printing facility under one roof on the planet was in Dayton, Ohio.
Amazing. Well, I mean, McCall's was printed there.
That's the plant, yes.
They had their magazines, I'm sure they printed there too.
4 million publications a day.
Oh my gosh.
They were running 24/7.
That's just amazing.
So it was a huge facility. And as I said, the largest one on the planet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so we have things like that. And then we have stories like the Mead Corporation.
Mead Corporation
that start making paper here, and they have plants that flourish all over the state. But it's those moments in time that we try and capture and preserve at the museum. And folks are surprised to know many times that, I had a trapper keeper when I was a kid. I didn't know that was Dayton, Ohio. I read that magazine. I read Newsweek in the 1960s. I didn't know it was printed in Dayton, Ohio.
No, a lot of people didn't.
Yeah. So it really is fun for folks to come through. We have, unfortunately, two groups of people or two minds of thought when they go through our entrepreneurship center. Folks that did not grow up here walk through and they say, oh my gosh, I had no idea. This is an amazing town that we have so many people, you know, unfortunately, that come through that grew up here. They're like, ah, Dayton was so great. What happened? And it's so we counter that because we have mixed in a lot of wonderful emerging stories about manufacturing and entrepreneurship in this town. Henny Penny is one of those.
Yeah, what a great company.
A great company and selling machinery all over the world.
Yes.
And so again, they're just outside of Dayton and Eaton, but we talk about the Dayton region. And so there are bright spots.
Oh,
and we do have a very bright future here in this town. And as we see folks come through and become inspired by the many stories that we tell at Carillon Park, you can say, you know, look what we did and look what we're still doing and look where we can go.
It's very, very fun to see all the things that have happened, but it's also fun to hear about the things that could be. And it's just by people's imagination what they want to put out there and how they can continue to expand and grow. I like the way that you have the pub out there now and the brewery. It's fun watching them brew some beer out there, and it's fun place to have events. We've had some nice corporate events in there too, with the beer, the cheese, the sausage, and that whole history of Dayton too.
Sure. Yeah, no, the consumer goods, you could say, that came out of Dayton. Certainly beer, it was one of those in the day. And
we towns had a lot of German influence.
Well, and that's correct. Yeah. And the idea being that in the 19th century, you couldn't necessarily trust the water. Now, you could trust it in Dayton.
Okay.
Dayton,
but a lot of communities, you couldn't.
Great water, but you couldn't. Yeah. And so to boil something, and they didn't quite understand why in the early days, why this was true, but you could boil something and it made it safe to drink. It was fortifying. And you have stories of people having a beer at breakfast, full families, even the kids. Those weren't heavy beers.
No,
those
were light beer.
They were
3.2 that we had in high
even less. Yeah. What they called small beers in the day.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was part of our history. And then, you know, food wise, a lot of folks don't realize that the Cheez-It came out of Dayton, Ohio in 1921.
Right. Sure. You're right.
And so you have football in 1920
and
the Cheez-It in 21. And you think, my gosh, those two have come together.
And
they both started in Dayton. I wish the NFL would spread that story more in those commercials that they put together. But and then local favorites, as you said, Mike Sells and Esther Price.
What a wonderful story.
And Square Cut Pizza. You have to come to Dayton to get your Square Cut Pizza.
Yeah, Marianne's
or Cassano's. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's fun stories. And that's, we have a gallery that many folks see at the Carillon that celebrates some of those celebrities, that familiar faces that people might see every day around the world and not know they're from Dayton, whether it's Martin Sheen or Allison Janney or Rob Lowe or Gary Sandy. They see these folks and they say, oh my gosh, I had no idea they're all from Dayton.
And you have some rotating exhibits that come in too, don't you?
We do. We have a special exhibit gallery, and we just finished one large exhibit on Prohibition.
Yes.
And
which is fascinating.
Women's suffrage. So we put those together, and that we just retired that. So
yes.
We're putting the plans together for the next one right now.
Okay.
And one of the things that is probably going to move into there is a large story about all the work that happened at the Miamisburg Mound facility.
Oh, right.
The laboratories. And again, folks, I don't think realize what a huge piece of the puzzle Dayton provided in the Manhattan Project, and providing the polonium triggers that made it possible to trigger or detonate the device at White Sands.
Right.
And the gadget, and certainly the device that was detonated over Nagasaki.
Sure.
Both of those to end, finally, the war in the Pacific and World War II.
And the code break.
So that happens too. Yeah. So we have another World War II story, that Dayton broke the four-rotor German U-boat code.
Right.
With their Enigma machine. So
we could just go on and on of all these stories.
We could.
We may have to do a second podcast.
Well,
here,
that's
Brady.
Fine. Invite
There's
me
just
back.
Too many
that's,
stories.
I'd enjoy that.
Yes. I think that would be fun.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for your time today. And before we go, Brady, you know, these are incredible stories, and we really thank you. You know, whether you're a Dayton native or not, it's wonderful to see how Dayton history is preserving Dayton's legacy. Before we wrap up, we just want to thank you for everything you've done. You've been an important part of this community for a long time, and we sure appreciate all the hard work and innovations and ideas and late nights and meetings that you attend and all the things that you do. And it's been wonderful to have you here. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us, and keep exploring the history in your communities and celebrating your heritage. And hopefully we'll get Brady back again for some more interesting stories about the Dayton community.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the NextGen Podcast. To learn more about our team and to join our exclusive educational events throughout the year, check out our website at advisors.ubs.com/Energen. If you have any suggestions on episodes you'd like to hear, let us know by emailing us at energen@ubs.com. And if you liked this episode, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to hear more.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.